whip. And on the way, you can find some other cork-brained idiot to pay your bills. He walked from the room with dignity, crossed the hall, waited for the footman to open the door, and stepped across the pavement into his coach that was waiting outside. He flung himself back against the cushioned seat. "Where to, my lord?" For a moment it seemed as though he had not heard the footman's question. There was a deep frown between his eyes, and his mouth was set in a hard line. "Where to, my lord?" The footman repeated the question a trifle nervously. "Home." The word came out like a pistol shot. The footman sprang up onto the box. "Home," he whispered to the coachman, "and his nibs be in a rare tantrum." The coach had already begun to move, and the driver turned his head to wink at the footman. "I bet you she wouldn't last long," he said. "Not but what she's cost him a pretty penny." "He can afford it," the footman countered laconically. Inside the coach, Lord Winchingham put his hand up to his forehead and then covered his eyes as though they hurt. In fact, he felt exceedingly ill. The brandy he had drunk last night in large quantities, the rich food he had consumed, and above all, the tension of the evening had all combined, when he did get to bed, to make sleep impossible. And as soon as it had been decently possible, he had risen and called for his coach, so that he could visit his mistress. He had no idea why he turned to her in his trouble, except that there had seemed no one else. And perhaps at the very back of his mind, behind the cynical facade that was so characteristic of him, was some youthful fantasy that believed that her continually voiced expressions of love had some basis in reality. He was to be speedily disillusioned. He had no sooner begun an explanation of his gaming losses the night before than Cleo de Castile, who incidentally had been christened Maisie Smith, produced a sheaf of bills, which she declared were his responsibility. He would not have minded so much had he not been convinced in his own mind that he had paid those selfsame bills only a fortnight earlier, or at least he had given Cleo the money to do so. What had started as a half-expressed appeal on his part for a little sympathy and understanding had ended in a furious quarrel, with Cleo de Castile making threatening demands and Lord Winchingham's final decision to be rid of her once and for all. Now, sitting back in the coach with his eyes closed, he wondered how he could ever have been so besotted as to have wasted so much of his money on such a particularly common and unpleasant strumpet. But Cleo was the fashion, and the fact that he had beaten two of his greatest friends in a race for her affection and carried her off from under the very nose of one of the richest and most powerful men at court had added both flavour and piquancy to the affair. Now he saw her for what she was, a loud-mouthed, hard-headed creature, whose only interest in any man was what she could get out of him. He counted up how much he had spent on her during these past 6 months, and clenched his teeth in a sudden fury. God, what I could not do with that money now! Through the fumes that still seemed to be in possession of his head and the throbbing of his temples, the scene last night came back to him in all its vividness. He had not been too foxed to know what he was doing. He realized that his luck was out. But like every gambler since the beginning of creation, he had believed that his luck would turn and the next card would be in his favour. The next, or the next. But Lambton had gone on winning and winning, and because they were old enemies across the Green Baize tables, he had not hesitated to taunt Lord Winchingham, needling him into making more and more extravagant bids, until, finally, £100,000 had waited on the turn of a card. Lord Winchingham could see his own six of diamonds staring up at him, and he thought now that he had known, even before Lambton's long, thin fingers very slowly turned his own card over, what it would be. In the split second before he actually saw what the card was, he had known that he was beaten. And, drunk though he was, he knew exactly what it meant. It was almost as though he saw a procession of his possessions passing away from him into Lambton's keeping. His house, his estate, the pictures his father had set so much store by, his horses.